Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us early on a Saturday morning to talk about citizen science tools and journalism. We're really pleased you could be with us. We're going to be discussing some very cool and innovative projects this morning. As the name suggests, we're going to be looking at some tools like for crowdsourcing and for using sensors to monitor environmental indicators that can be used for journalism, to collect data for journalism. If you've been following the whole progress and debate over citizen journalism, I think you might find that a lot of the same issues faced there are also faced with citizen science, in that there's tremendous potential to get new data and information from these sources, but there are also issues of quality, reliability, and accuracy. And those are some of the issues we're going to be discussing today. So we're very pleased to have some very cool and innovative people with us to discuss these topics. My name is James Fahn, as the name tag suggests, and I am the director of Internews' Earth Journalism Network. Very briefly, we are a global network of over 5,000 journalists around the world who cover environmental issues, all kinds of topics from climate change to biodiversity and oceans and environmental health. And we're always looking for ways to improve the quantity and quality of environmental coverage. We're close collaborators with SEJ over the years. And we believe, or I certainly believe, that using these tools for crowdsourcing sensors really offers a tremendous amount of potential for changing the way we, almost changing the way we view the environment. I think right now, for instance, we're used to getting data and information from the government. We're getting ambient information. What's the air quality like in our cities, or what's the air quality like in our regions? The use of sensors will allow us to get that information. What's it like on our block, in our house, in our kitchen? These are things we've never really had the chance to get before, this kind of information, unless without paying a lot of money and getting a lot of expertise. But that these devices, sensors, are becoming cheaper and easier to use all the time. Crowdsourcing is also allowing the mobilization of a wide range of data in a way we've never been able to do before. So I think it's really exciting times for this kind of work. And we have a great group of panelists this morning who I think are going to shed a lot of light on the work that's being done, the latest work. You have their bios, so I'm not going to go into detail, but briefly, Shannon Dos-Megan, to my left, is the founder and executive director of Public Lab, and she's based here in New Orleans. Also based in here in New Orleans is Julia Kumari Drapkin from IC Change, founder of IC Change. To her left is Adam Glenn, an educator at the City University of New York and a digital media consultant. And to his left is Willie Schubert, my colleague at Internews' Earth Journalism Network and kind of our digital guru there. So I think you're going to learn a lot this morning. And, of course, we're going to try and keep our presentation short. I know that SEJ usually frowns on PowerPoints, but in many cases, for this kind of work, it can be important to show what's going on screen. So we are going to be doing some PowerPoints, but I have asked the panelists to please limit their talks to about 7 minutes, and that should leave plenty of time for Q&A. We're really hoping to hear your questions and your thoughts on these exciting topics. What else can I tell you? I think you already know the ground rules for Q&A. I'll repeat them when the time comes, but as always, we're going to ask you to state your name, where you're from, and we'll give preference to SEJ members first. But without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Shannon to please start things off.
Great, thank you. All right, as James said, I'm Shannon Shannon Dosmagan. I'm the executive director of Public Lab. I personally am based in New Orleans. We have offices in a couple other cities, but we're at the core a nonprofit that supports a global open source community of over 9,000 people that are interested in creating DIY style, low cost tools to do environmental monitoring projects with. So we have a number of different tools and areas that we work within, but I'm going to focus specifically on the one that really kickstarted the organization, got us thinking in the direction that we did. It happened very locally during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that I'm sure all of you have been hearing about over the last couple of days. All right, and we're going to progress. All right, I'm going to have to slide these. Sorry, this is a PDF. Okay, so back in 2010, I was working for a local nonprofit called the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. We were an organization that was doing community air sampling near the fence lines of oil refineries, which we have many of throughout the state of Louisiana. And the Deepwater Horizon oil spill happened. So we immediately had to change focuses. But one of the things that we noticed was that within days, there was a basic media blackout that was happening. So we thought, you know, what are we going to do to help people engage with what's literally unfolding in the waters off the shore of where they live, where people fish, you know, the lands that are important to our communities. So the very first thing that I worked on was launching an instance of a Ushahidi platform. This was a way for people to send in citizen reports. As I continued to work on it, I didn't feel like it was the most robust way to get people really involved. It was hard to give the data that people were sending back out to communities. So we started to think a little bit bigger. And this is where the base for Public Lab came. What we did, I partnered with a couple other people, and we started to launch balloons and kites with very simple point-and-shoot cameras over the Gulf of Mexico. So a few days after the spill happened, there was a flight cap that was put, so you couldn't fly below 3,000 feet and collect good imagery. But we would take these balloons, one of which is pictured on the right-hand side, with cameras, and we would send them up literally from the ground about 1,500 feet. The BP oil spill was also where many of our other questions came from that have directed how we've created tools. So walking the beaches, we would also come across these large tar balls, as you can see in the left-hand side. And this is really what prompted us to create other pollution detection devices, such as spectrometers, because we wanted to figure out how can we identify what is happening in our own environment without having to send samples to the lab. So sending up kites and cameras again, 1,500 feet into the air, we collected over 100,000 different images of the Gulf oil spill during the course of the first 5 months. We mapped over 100 miles of coastline, and we were able to engage over 200 different people. And this included locals from, you know, many different walks of life in Southeast Louisiana and Mississippi, people who were out wanting to see what had happened to their favorite fishing areas, people that were desperately coming down to the Gulf Coast and wanting to figure out ways to get involved as they watched this tragedy, you know, literally happen. So going back to the tool itself, we used a kit that looks basically like this. It's been modified quite a few times. I'm going to mention the open sourceness of it and how that happens. But at the time, this kit cost us about, I would say, $70 to put together. So it's basically a balloon. There's a 2-liter soda bottle that acts as a stabilizing rig, some twine to actually hold the balloon. So $80, if we were using the balloons, we'd have to get helium. But we used three of these kits during the course of the oil spill. So imagine that. That's under $300 to collect 100,000 different images and engage hundreds of people and actually doing that data collection and being able to tell the story that they see unfolding. So as I was mentioning, we use open source licensing, and this is one of the really wonderful ways that we've been able to grow the project. So in the top left hand, the second image in was the very first rig that we used during the oil spill. It was a simple 2-liter soda bottle top with cardboard stabilizing wings. But you all might feel it. It is quite wet here. It's quite humid. So you send that up and that cardboard wilts immediately. So because of our licensing and the ability for people to modify without having to go back to manufacture, we started creating other versions of the rigs that would hold up to the humidity. So we're plastic completely and would help keep the camera from spinning around in mad circles as we send it up into the air. So this is what nonprofits, maybe journalists, I'm not a journalist myself, are used to looking for information during disasters such as this. This is a pretty bad satellite image, and you can kind of see that it's hard to differentiate what they're depicting as heavily oiled, which is the red lines, and lightly oiled, which is the light green lines. So on the exact same day that this satellite image was taken, a group of grassroots mappers, as we called them, went out to Wilkinson Bay as well and took aerial images at a much higher resolution of the exact same plot of land. So the images that they stitched together look like this. So this collected set of community data tells a much different story, that it's quite a bit harder to differentiate where the heavily oiled areas and the low oiled areas might be in the set of images. So this is what we were collecting during the oil spill and have contributed to a massive public domain archive since then. But it's not enough just to have those individual images. So Public Lab also works towards creating open source software platforms. So we can take the raw images and basically translate them back into languages of geographic power. So images that can be shared and spread and used much more widely. So taking images, transporting them into our web browser-based software system called MapNetter, and being able to create geotiffs and JPEGs and images such as that. And with these images, as I mentioned, we then provide them into a public domain archive. So anybody can go and retrieve the maps, the raw images themselves, and they can also collect all of the metadata. So they know the exact coordinates. They know everybody who was involved in collecting those images and creating the maps. And you also can get field notes, videos, pictures from on the ground. So the ancillary story as well. In Southeast Louisiana, as in many other places, one of the other important things has been to go back to, I guess you could say, print journalistic forms. So we also use formats such as the Grassroots Mapping Forum that has many of the maps that we have collected as a community, stories from the area, interviews, and those get distributed widely in the location in which they were collected. And then finally, one of the important things that we did during the oil spill and that we use till today is that we created a partnership with Google Earth and Google Maps. So anytime you go into Google Earth and you see on the left-hand side imagery public laboratory, that means that you can click on it and you can go back to all of the metadata that was in that map. So all the individual images, the resolution, and the actual map itself. So because of our licensing, we have seen this project, as I said, we're now at a community of 9,000 people. We are generously supported by the Knight Foundation. We've won 2 Knight News Challenge grants as a civic media organization. And we continue to grow the suite of tools that we have from riffle water quality monitors looking at the health of water to using air sensors to look at indoor air quality and dust monitoring around sand frack sites. So we span a very broad range of tools and subject matters. And I hope that as we go through questions and answers, I can be of help in how you might use these kind of tools in your work as well.
Trapkin, and let's see what we got here. Whoop. Okay, slideshow. All right. I'm so honored to be here. I love working with Shannon, and I've worked with Willie a little bit, and just met these two over here this week. And we're here to talk about sensors and new ways of reporting stories. And IC Change is dedicated to connecting people to each other and their changing environment online. And as the climate continues to change, we're going to be making critical decisions about our infrastructure, our energy, our food, without historical weather records as a dependable guide. And those changes correlate to our energy balance and the productivity of our ecosystems. And we're trying to map an invisible gas. I'm sorry, I'm getting nervous. Is it hot in here? Is it just me, or is my garden going funny this year? Is it just me, or is my asthma or my allergies worse than ever this year? Yeah? All right. Is it just me, or is it weird to have snow days in the south and a heat wave at the Winter Olympics? Has anyone else had questions in addition to this man over here? Okay, well, we have all had questions like that. And we know, as science journalists, that it's really difficult to answer those questions. Science and journalists have a problem, and that is a question and a problem of scale. We know that taking large amounts of time and space and trying to drill down into anyone's individual story or experience is impossible when you look at climate models. Right? They keep telling us, no, we can't answer that with certainty. We can't answer that with certainty. And because we can't answer those questions, we can't track impacts. We can't implement solutions. When I was a climate reporter in D.C., I was working with the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and I said, look, guys, why can't we make any adaptation headway? And I said, look, I can't go to a congressman and tell him this is how much climate change is impacting your district. Science has a really difficult time of doing that. And so I started thinking about this as a journalist. How could I get around this problem of reporting climate change and how it impacts local communities? And I said, well, what if we started the process in reverse? You know, a typical science story begins with the scientist. The scientist makes an observation and asks a question, writes a research paper, and we do a story about that. What if we started, you know, reversing that process? What if we started with the community's observations and their questions and started matching that with science and scientists and reporting on that? What if we could reach climate data halfway? If the local community could reach up halfway and meet the data community halfway, what would that conversation look like? So I got a grant in 2012 from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I was a radio reporter, and went to Western Colorado to find out. And I spent a year talking with ranchers and farmers and fishermen, asking them, well, what are you seeing change, and what's your question for a scientist? And some of the most fascinating stories started to happen. We started also realizing that people keep notes. They keep, you know, journals about change and variation over time that they can reference when that drought from 1977 starts looking like it's rearing its head again. And I was like, oh, my God, what does this look like? What does this look like? Well, maybe it looks like this. Has anyone remember this thing? This is the longest running publication in the history of the United States. It was an adaptation strategy designed for people coming to a new land that was unfamiliar so that they could keep tracks of changes over time and make decisions. But it's the old farmer's almanac. They still run this. You find this in the grocery store. But it wasn't designed with 21st century technology for 21st century climate change. So we developed a prototype, the almanac.org, which brings in, you know, your basic temperature, precipitation, and snowfall data against 30-year averages and collects observations and posts from the community over time so that they could start diarying their changes. And what we found was anomalies jumped out. Suddenly, we were reporting on West Nile virus, droughts, wildfires, and the earliest spring in the history of the United States, weeks to months in advance of mainstream news. And we started radio reporting out of that. And so what we realized is that not only do we have this innovative way to report climate change, co-report it with the community, break news, we also had a model that was scalable. We launched IC Change, the almanac.org, in January of 2013, and our funding ran out in February of 2013. Everything that you see on the almanac is unfunded. I am living in New Orleans. I am not living in Western Colorado. And I just want to show you how it can work. This is a little radio story produced by a guy who had little to no environmental radio reporting experience in Western Colorado. He was a radio reporter, though. And he took a picture of this fog that he thought was eerie in September of 2013, and this is the story he produced out of it. Oh, can you hear this?
Bug showed up in Colorado a couple weekends ago, along with cooler temperatures.
Ah, I forgot to plug in my audio. Terrible radio producing, isn't it? Okay, let's try that again. Yeah, let's do that.
Strange heavy patches of low-lying clouds and thick fog showed up in Colorado a couple weekends ago, along with cooler temperatures, a welcome change from a heat wave that felt much longer than the week it lasted. I noticed the clouds eerily hanging over the mountain passes on I-70, driving back from Denver Monday morning. 4 days later, those clouds let loose historic amounts of rainfall over the Front Range, devastating the area with the worst flooding the state's ever seen. Records were broken, and the storm rekindled rough memories of the 1976 Big Thompson flood.
What you were seeing were signs that conditions were ripe for rainfall and heavy rainfall.
Andrew Friedman writes for Climate Central, an online climate change magazine. One of his meteorologist friends told him Boulder felt like Houston in the days before the storm. Muggy, almost tropical, definitely unusual for Colorado in September. But according to Friedman, scientists have actually been noticing more of these oddly timed extreme rain events across the country, partly because our atmosphere is getting warmer and can hold more water than it used to. Bob Henson, a meteorologist at UCAR, that's the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, says the moisture buildup itself wasn't that strange. It was mostly just the timing.
It's a little bit like a large-scale version of a sea breeze, where during the middle hours of the day, the land near the ocean coast heats up and creates a pressure pattern that tends to pull in moist air from the ocean. It's just that that usually doesn't happen this intensely in September.
And if you've been following the press on the floods, usually might sound like an understatement.
We're going to turn now to what's being called biblical flooding across Colorado.
This has been called a 1-in-1,000-year flood.
Okay, so that I love that story because I didn't produce it. And a climate reporter didn't produce it. And it came from noticing change. But what if you could match that post with the, you know, relative humidity sensors in a cell phone? What if the ambient temperature was recorded or the barometric pressure? All of a sudden, these little phones are becoming mobile weather stations. The Android phone is being shipped with environmental sensors built in. So in 2015, not only are we trying to scale a model of reporting with new partner stations, we're trying to do it mobily. So IC Change will be mobile, and we have two new science partners who are helping us do that. We're working with the Beacon Network in Oakland, as well as NASA JPL. So in as much as I spent a year working with Colorado farmers and ranchers figuring out how to do this, I also, the next year, spent a year with scientists. Shannon was actually part of that process. And it is not easy working with those guys. But we made it happen. And so basically, the Beacon Network is, they've put 40 carbon sensors on schools and museums in the Bay Area. And they're going to be studying carbon at the cityscape level with sensors. NASA just launched its new OCO2 mission in July, and it's going to be measuring carbon from space. So we're going to be starting to take on new remote sensing data just as the community is near sensing, collecting their story posts, their questions, and seeing how these things line up over time. So what do you get from that? When you match the near sensing and the sensor data and the satellite data, we're starting to create like what I envision or hope to be a citizen science story core. I hate to use those terms exactly, but that's what we got right now as we start to put it together. And basically, what kinds of stories are we going to be telling? Well, every 16 days, we're going to send a note to our user community. Hey, the satellite's passing overhead. What are you seeing change? You'll get a message if you're using the app. Likewise, with our partner stations, you'll get a call out. Hey, what are you seeing change? And we're going to have people, posting their observations in their posts, and we're going to be looking at the data over time and seeing what kinds of different stories we can produce. By layering this data together, I'm just giving you an example. Someone asked me, well, what kinds of stories are we going to be talking about here? With OCO2, you're going to be measuring carbon sources and sink from space. At the cityscape level, you may be able to drill down and see emission patterns, traffic patterns. Local communities will be able to talk about health impacts, air quality, how their traffic is changing. So that's Milwaukee. Actually, that's a mock-up of Milwaukee. of where their energy and their carbon sources and things are. I mean, sources. On the other side is a symbol of what is a carbon with regards to photosynthesis. So OCO2 is measuring carbon emissions, but it's also measuring photosynthesis from space in a new way. It's called solar-induced fluorescence. Basically, when plants are photosynthesizing, they're emitting light. And you can see that at a totally awesome scale of 60 square kilometers. It's the size of a city. So when plants are stressed, they're actually going to, that chemical signature is going to be visible from space. We're going to be able to, so anyway, why does this matter? Well, because it's a totally different way of using data and stories together. It's two-way. We're working with the community to co-report. We're using new sensor data and new satellite data. And we have an awesome team. Again, Ron Cohen from Berkeley is jumping on as our to help us map carbon from the Bay Area. Karen Yuen and the OCO2 team, the entire mission, is working with us on this to create this citizen science core. And I have awesome little geniuses here in New Orleans and in Boston. So basically, that's the vision. We know this can work because we have a model that works without the bells and the whistles all on its own. If you take away satellites, if you take away sensors, if you just use this model of reporting, it'll blow your mind. And we already have like partners that we're working with in the next couple weeks. But when we start adding in data, we really think that we're going to be truly inventing a new way of climate reporting. And it's climate requires of us to ask new questions and to report in new ways because the ways that we've been working haven't been working. That's all I got. That's all I got.
Thanks a lot. I'm really impressed by these two projects and feeling a little naked at the moment because I'm the one digital guy up here without a laptop and a presentation. But I got talking points and actually, Julia is going to help by putting up I'm going to talk about a website that I launched a year ago called adaptny.org. And I'll talk particularly about the crowdsourcing. And it's somewhat lower, a little lower tech, but I think it's equally valuable. So just very, very quickly in the way of background, I launched this project, adaptny.org, after Sandy. And there are really a couple of purposes. One, I think, will be very familiar to you, which is the problem that stories like climate change, which are ongoing, often wax and wane in terms of public attention. And media attention, for that matter. So one of the aims of this project was to keep the conversation going, to keep the question of climate, and particularly in New York, the question of climate adaptation in front of the stakeholder public. And that was the other part. The stakeholders in this story, which are many, I wanted to see if there's a way to better engage them in the story itself. Oh, yes, we have forgotten what it's a phone number, right? You got it memorized. Impressive. It is. It's not critical, but if we can get it up, it'd be great. I'll keep going. So the stakeholder engagement was the other main aim. Now, you know, the project has many facets, and you could look, you'll see there's a curation element to try to bring forward some of the most interesting reporting and information. We do, you know, old-fashioned investigative reporting. I have community workshopping going on, but the thing I want to focus on here is the crowdsourcing. In the wake of Sandy in New York, the then Mayor Michael Bloomberg released a very extensive multi-billion-dollar resiliency plan for the city. That was the summer of 2013, 400 plus pages, 250 initiatives, $19 billion over a couple of decades to be spent on this problem. The issue that I saw was that it was a beautifully produced report, a sort of McKinsey-level quality, very exemplary in that sense, but with relatively little public input, and particularly from the neighborhoods that were going to be most affected by some of these solutions. So what I wanted to try and do was find a way for the communities themselves that would be affected by these solutions to have a voice in whether they thought they were good or not, or would work or not. I'm sorry to put you through this.
AdaptNY.
That's, yeah, there you go. That's okay.
There we go.
Thank you so much. So what I did is I approached, and if actually if you go to just click on documents and the stronger, documents, yeah, and see it says stronger, more resilient New York. Mm-hmm. This is the Bloomberg report, and what you'll see is fairly familiar, which is essentially a PDF, as you scan down the page, a PDF of this 400-page report. And Document Cloud, which many of you may know, has been working with news organizations and others to help ease the process of putting these massive documents online. What was missing, though, was a way for the public to just annotate the document, to share their thoughts and comments and critique, highlight elements, saying this is true, this is bullshit, whatever it might be. Now, that capability existed within news organizations. As a news organization, I could upload a document and then a group of editors could annotate it. So I approached Document Cloud. Yeah, it's probably because it's such a huge document. Yeah, there, click, and you'll get it. In any case, I approached Document Cloud and say, why not make available as a publicly annotated tool. As it turns out, they were already thinking along the same lines, so it was very easy to pair up, to partner. There you go. And if you scan on the page, you'll see it. Okay. So it was very easy to partner with them to develop this public annotation tool. This, I think, has a lot of power. In many different settings, you can imagine, a city council issuing, a draft regulation, and a community being engaged to say, "Well, does this make sense? Does this work for us?" And to share with each other and with the city council or whatever the government body is, what makes sense and what doesn't. I'll give you in the few minutes I have left, and there's a lot more behind this, but I'll give you a few lessons that I learned from this process because I think they're valuable if you want to do something like this. Let me ask a question. How many folks in here know the phrase use case? Okay, one person. And that was me, too. I was like, use case? When you're working with a developer, the developer spent like hours trying to help me understand what a use case was. I had no idea what he was talking about, and he didn't want to do anything until I had my use case. A use case, which is a very valuable process, as I've learned, is just identifying who your user is and how they're going to use your product, right? So he kept wanting to know, well, who's going to go to this? What are they going to do when they go to this? What are they going to do if they don't get what they want, et cetera, et cetera? And so if you're developing a project of any kind with a web or tech developer, make sure you understand your use case. I've since learned a lot about this, and it's a very valuable process. Journalists typically don't know anything about it. In my situation, I selected as my use case initially landscape architects, and this was lesson number two. These are folks who are very engaged in this question of what New York City is going to look like, the geography of New York in a resilient setting. Very enthusiastic about this project when I brought it to them, that what a great idea. Enthusiasm does not translate into action in many cases, and that's what I found here for very simple reasons, which I didn't anticipate. Like in the summertime, this report was released in June. In the summertime, landscape architects are not sitting at their desk. They're out on their locations, out on their sites. So getting them to focus on this, as important as it was, as interested as they were, was very difficult. And in most cases, all they could do was use their phone. And you can't read a 400-page PDF on a phone, really, or even an iPad, perhaps. But more subtly than that, also, I think I realized that many of these folks were engaged in trying to this was their business, and there's a lot of money flowing in and around New York around this resiliency thing, many, many millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. And the last thing these guys wanted to do was piss off people who might be able to fund their, $30 million project by having some annotation in here saying, this isn't smart. So that's one set of lessons. The other set of lessons is with the development partner, besides the use case learning curve. Also, I was very fortunate in a sense to find that we were working along the same pathway, Document Cloud and myself. However, that meant that they had their plans. And so in cases where I wanted to deviate, it was really a challenge because they naturally wanted to do what they needed to do for their product, not what I needed for mine. So if you find someone who's working on a parallel path, just be aware of that. Otherwise, you need to give them money. And I had a little bit of grant money, but not enough to really shift their path. I'll just end by saying that the project is ongoing. This part of the project is ongoing, in part because now the new administration, Bill de Blasio, the new mayor of New York, is having to turn back around and look at this massive document. And a lot of people are saying, well, what are you doing about resiliency? And so far, the administration has not really articulated what they're doing, but they are due to have a major a status report this spring. So my intention is to come back to this, either Document Cloud or another partner is creating this kind of tool, and revisit this. And in this case, the lesson learned is, first of all, there are other annotation tools out there. There's still, it's a formative technology, public annotation, but there's a tool, for instance, called News Genius. And a lot of these, you know, they have obscure origins. Like News Genius was originally called Rap Genius, which was a couple of Yale students wanted to figure out what rap lyrics meant, so they created this tool. And now it's evolved, and actually it's just called Genius now, but it's a public annotation tool. And there's another, for instance, called Truth Goggles. And if any of you know Dan Schultz, he's the son of Beth Park, who's the SEJ executive director, and he's gotten money from Mozilla Foundation and others to create a public annotation layer. A lot of this has to do with verification and fact-checking on the web in general, to create a layer on top of it to question what people are seeing. Okay, so I'll wrap up. And there are others I can let you know afterwards. But so the lesson number one is, you know, who is the proper partner? And lesson number two is, who is the use case? And I'm going to refocus my attention on a much tighter locale. In this case, rather than a domain expert like a landscape architect, it will be a neighborhood that's underserved, and see what they're getting. So I'll stop there, but I will mention then maybe during the Q&A we can talk about, there is one other crowdsourcing project going on which is related to this that AdaptNY and the CUNY J School where I teach are working on, which is on mold, and it's called Hack the Mold, and we're using crowdsourcing techniques to get at mold remediation problems in public housing after Sandy, which is a huge issue in New York. But I'll stop there, and if you have questions about that, I can definitely answer them. Thanks very much.
And thank you.
Whoa.
I lost my name.
It's Willie.
So, hi everyone, my name is Willie Schubert. I'll get to that in a second, but we're going to talk about something decidedly high-tech, which is sensors, and that's sensor with an S, not sensor with a C. So when you hear this term, what we're really talking about is monitoring. We're talking about recording information about air pollution, various environmental issues, and what I want to do today is kind of take you through the journey that we've gone on to develop these air quality monitors, why we've done it, and to what end. So, again, my name's Willie. I work with InterNews, the Earth Journalism Network, which is a global network of environmental journalists, about 5,000 in total. And my job is to provide support for environmental journalists to cover global topics. And, you know, these big global topics are always bigger than any one issue. And so one of the ways that we've been trying to do that is by marshaling evidence, whether it's from a satellite or from a government or an NGO. And one of the things that we found increasingly across the world is that it's just very difficult to find quality information. So what I'm going to be talking about today is one answer to that kind of an issue, and that's a thing called the Dustduino. And as you see, a little preview about Public Lab. And where you can find more information. We'll get there on this story too. But I want to tell you where the inspiration for this really came from. And it's from Illinois. It's an industrial accident, a big tire fire that happened right next to a community and a school that lasted. I'm sure you know about tire fires. They last for a long time, and every couple days, fire department comes out to put up new flares, And so people in the community had questions about this. Here's a letter that we obtained through FOIA from a school teacher asking an EPA regulator about, you know, that everyone has sore throats and nothing seems to be being done. And so the response was that, you know, maybe you're getting carbon soot on your feet. And when we asked for the actual air quality information about, you know, if the EPA was monitoring any of this, they said that they had no records. So it's obvious that there's a big fire and a big problem, and it's clear that people are being affected by it. But the capacity to actually create that evidence of that impact in a scientific way that can be used by journalists beyond the anecdotal is really difficult. So the next step, like that's really our reasoning here. The next step was at a conference like this one at Columbia J School, the Toe Center. And so they brought together a bunch of people really kind of looking forward at what is sensor journalism, what is the potential for this, how are people using it, who are the actors in it, and kind of convening people to think. And we looked at a wide variety of projects, some of them kind of whimsical, like the cicada tracker for Radiolab, where they were looking at, you know, basically getting people to build soil temperature monitors so that they could predict when cicadas would come up and kind of have a two-way kind of communication and participation in this storytelling. Then we also learned about the SafeCast, which is a radiation detector. It's a DIY Geiger counter where it also has internet connectivity and a GPS so that you can go and buy a Geiger counter, but it won't collect where are you, what time is it, all of that other information. So people built it themselves and went out to Fukushima, and now they're also in Iraq, looking at what's the radiation levels, looking at the invisible with a device. And, you know, we all kind of sat around tables talking and putting our post-it notes on the board and thinking about this in the long term. Like, what are the privacy implications of this? What are the potential benefits, this new sunlight that's being cast into these dark corners? And how do you actually get these things out as news organizations? Because it's not really our domain, typically. And so I invite you to look at this new report. It's called by Fergus Pitts at the Toe Center. And it's about sensors and journalism. It's kind of the product of this meeting. Well, there were a couple of other products of this meeting. And one of them was we started thinking about this and tried to get a small amount of money to start experimenting with sensors and figuring out, oh, this seems like something that's really valuable. We do a lot of data journalism products or projects. And so we got a small pot of money and came here a year ago, actually, to SEJ in Chattanooga. And while James and I were here, we ran into this guy, Matt Schroyer, who was living in Illinois and had noticed that problem with the tire fire. And we got to talking and said, hey, we should collaborate and we should figure out how we can take this idea that we've discovered and say, hey, I know journalists in Mongolia who said that, you know, it's the worst air pollution here, and the same thing in Delhi, and the same thing in Paris, and the same thing in Beijing. All these cities say they have the worst air pollution in the world. How can that be true at the same time? So we started a sensor journalism and civic science project together to say, okay, let's see how we could make this work with journalists in developing countries to answer questions that they have in the course of their reporting or just out of their own curiosity. And I think there's a lot to the curiosity and whimsy of citizen science that we can tap into as journalists of just the desire to explore and understand the world around us. So we started trying to understand, well, what is this sensor stuff? How do we do this? And so right now this is the actual thing, the sensor, the monitor, and it works on some pretty cool principles. So we had to understand, what are the principles of this device? And so this is about the size of a post-it note, it looks a lot bigger now. But the way it works is that, see, this heating element pulls in air because of a temperature inversion. And then there's little dust particles that come in, and they get blasted with the light. And then there's basically like a camera that's taking a picture through a lens and it's saying how many particles are in here right now. And this thing costs $13. Wow, $13. So, but how do we get that information back to the internet, back to us? And is it really reliable? So the next step was working with scientists and talking with them about doing these kind of calibrations and is this accurate enough for us to use? And so what they did is a scientist from University of Washington named Edmund Sato and also at University of Cal Berkeley, and they put these devices next to $10,000 pieces of equipment at EPA monitoring sites and said, what's the data quality? And they found that at hourly intervals, there was negligible difference between a $10,000 equipment and a $13 device. So what are we actually looking for? What is the main issue? Because, you know, we can talk a lot about sensing, monitoring. Some things are more difficult than others. Like water is really tough because there's a lot of it. There's also a lot of air, but it's easier to take small snippets and understand a highly local issue. So these are particulates, PM 2.5, PM10, you probably know about it and as environmental journalists. And so what we're really looking for is PM 2.5 because it's so small that it goes through the lungs into the blood, causes cancer. So this is how that $10,000 piece of equipment works. And so the EPA or cities set these up, and usually it's like 10 to 15 per city, and they aggregate information and they say, in general, your city is like this. This is the general level of air pollution. And the way that it works is the different levels of the different sizes kind of fall through these collector plates until you go down and then people check. And anyway, and this is how we're using it, which I kind of explained earlier, but there's more. So why? What are the big picture takeaways for why? So why did we choose particulate matter? Well, it has one of the highest health impacts in the world. The WHO has said that 3.2 million people die a year from the health impacts of particulate matter. The second thing is that we found that we could actually look at it in an accurate way. We had that kind of scientific validation to say, you can do this and the data won't be, you know, just more data. That means nothing. The third is that, you know, the cost is right. So the issue is there, the quality is good, and the cost is right. And then the gap in the quality is shrinking, so that this is a new field that is potentially available to us to engage our citizens and our readers. So what happened after that is we started working with makers, and this is a fab lab in Urbana. I'll go a little faster. So there's maker communities, there's technologists, and we're trying to expand our communities of environmental journalists to include technologists and scientists more closely so that there's a collaboration. Here's a makerspace that also worked on this project and built a prototype. This was the first prototype, and we started putting this in homes and found, you know, kind of funny things. It's like, okay, you can put this in your kitchen and find out when you're cooking bacon. You know, there's a spike in PM when bacon is being cooked. And so we started thinking, what are the other causes of dust in the house, these indoor air pollution issues? And so we went to the University of Illinois in Urbana, and we said, okay, we're going to calibrate these things, and we're going to look at, you know, okay, we're going to set them all up, and we're going to look at kitty litter. And because kitty litter actually causes a fair amount of dust, and how bad is it for you? So we found, and what are the potential solutions there? So we found out, yes, kitty litter does cause dust in your house. If you add little paper pellets, you can reduce that amount of dust. And actually, the baseline for many homes for particulate matter is pretty standard. There is a baseline. And then we started building the prototypes so that we could manufacture more of them. How do you actually build them now that we've got a prototype? From prototype to what? So, yeah. So we do this thing called PCB prototyping, where we're basically building circuit boards with these aforementioned communities, and we created a kit. So we created a kit and then said, you can build it yourself. Here's all the stuff. Here's how to do it. And we posted it on the public lab, which I'll get to a little later. And then we brought a group of journalists together at Berkeley and did a training, and we said, here, you can have one, go out, play with it, figure out what to do with it yourself, and we'll help you set it up. So here's Matt, and he's talking about this is the kit and blah, blah, blah. And this is one of the first tests. It was from Indonesia. Somebody, our partner, Clara Rondwanu from Equatorial, she put one of these things in her car while she was sitting in traffic and was like, well, how, you know, what's it like? What am I being exposed to in traffic as I sit here 3 hours every day? And then the next group is in Mongolia, where we started looking at outdoor sensors. And so with solar panels and not internet, but actually mesh networking, so it's kind of getting a little high tech. I can take questions on that a little later. And what we're trying to do is set these things up in the coldest capital in the world, which says it has one of the worst air pollutions, which is Ulaanbaatar. And now we have 5 sensors in Ulaanbaatar that we're working with the Press Institute of Mongolia to set up and to monitor. And here's, you know, shipping it there. I'll get to that a little later, but yeah. It got stuck in customs for about 3 weeks, and we had to pay a bribe to get it out. So how do we keep staying open and helping whomever wants, being part of a community? Okay. All right, so public lab. Manufacturing is important because shipping sucks, and there's lots of parts to make these things. So we're working with a company in Shenzhen to actually build 100 of these things this fall and send them to Brazil, Indonesia, and Mongolia. And that the key lessons here are to be open with the design so that we're trying to be as transparent as possible, putting in multiple places how to do this, what are we doing, what are we thinking, how are we testing. Collaborative with new communities and patient because it takes, it's hard to do. Focus on the tough questions that need answering because this is kind of a high value way to tackle an issue. Be sure to include scientists, but understand that science is a process and not a title, and that we can be scientists if we follow a method and work together. And actually, many scientists are interested in this. And find someone else to handle the shipping. And I don't know, I don't have any answers for customs. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Willie. Okay, so there, I think you got a real taste of a lot of the exciting work being done out there in the field. And I would just add, and so we're going to open it up for Q&A now. As usual, please, you know, raise your hand, state, and if called upon, state your name and where you're from. Yes, I'm going to hand over the microphone.
Hi, I'm Dave Polson. I teach environmental journalism at Michigan State University. I teach a class in the use of remote sensing for environmental journalism. But I wondered if you could maybe address the non-technical aspects and the role of journalists in terms of something beyond the very important role that we have of interpreting data and creating stories and putting stuff in context, but the whole idea of aggressively being the organizer, the convener, the group that goes out to recruits the citizen scientists and sets up the whole project. Are you seeing many news organizations interested in doing that? Is there a way of jump-starting that and pushing that? Is it too early yet? Is it an important role for journalists, news organizations to play? Or is it better off letting the citizen groups putting this stuff together and, oh, by the way, a journalist comes along and reports on what they're doing?
Well, I can make a pass at it. If you consider like New York Daily News to be sort of a sufficient indicator on this mold project, the New York Daily News has been covering mold after Sandy. It's reached a crisis level, partly because the city was doing very little to help remediate. Federal courts had to actually step in to speed the process up, but they're doing the standard, shoe leather reporting. So they jumped at the chance, which was actually unexpected to us at the J School when we approached them about doing a crowdsourced project using various techniques to both measure mold and document it for individuals in public housing. They jumped at the chance to be part of that. So I think that they see that as their community. Their readership is their community in New York, and that sort of lower income community that lives in public housing is very important to them. And they had no compunction, we found, about instigating a project like that?
Just in terms of, I think that there's different levels in which people are interested in participating, and that it's really, you know, certain groups are like really interested in the DIY and tinkering and like kind of getting their hands dirty, and then there's other people that you're trying to reach who are being impacted by environmental change who are more just, you know, you're lucky to try and fit into their ritual and to their daily habit. So for IC Change, we were trying to reach people who weren't necessarily able to work with mobile phones or on the web. So our platform works, you know, in its most basic naked form, just as a call out on a radio show. Hey, what are you seeing change? And what's your question for a scientist? And it's that fundamental idea of co-reporting with the community that is extraordinarily powerful. And then you can work up with from there. So we just had an article in Running Current about our new partners in with Berkeley and with NASA, and that we're going to be writing an RFP for new public media stations to jump on, you know, and we're going to try and offer IC Change at different levels. You know, the most basic level is just, hey, let's work with your community to co-report what, you know, what the impacts are of weather and climate. If you want to download the app that NASA is developing, because they're putting in the development money, and awesome, even all the better. If you want to go forward and throw a sensor on your phone and actually measure like carbon from the atmosphere and experiment with that, awesome. But I'm not going to like make an assumption that everybody is going to want to, you know, jump in and get really, really techie. I'm trying to hit the low hanging fruit and then build up from there.
I think also for us, we've seen tons of journalists use our work and use the data. It creates these kind of grotesquely beautiful images of environmental issues. One of the things that we've had difficulty working with community media rooms, journalists, is that the timeline is much different. So I think one of the interesting things that Willie pointed out in his last slide was open hardware, you have to have a lot of patience. It's about a collaborative, long-term process. And just from the interactions that I've had with community media rooms, it's quite a bit different. You're looking for, you know, quick solutions. You've got to get the story out. So there's not always that time to really, you know, sit and saturate on a project.
Next question?
Willie has something, too.
So just be really brief. I'd say in my experience, if there's any advice that I have, it would be that journalists are natural conveners. I mean, we're part of communities, we're a part of the community that we report in, and we organize information. That's who we are. But I agree on that question of, are we the right people to lead this? Because we don't have time necessarily. I think that's the big point. I think it's easier as a first step to become a participant in the community, because we're not going to do it ourselves. I mean, we have to expand what we consider as our community, so that there are including scientists and they're including technologists. Like a lot of the things that we do, we organize citizen campaigns through NGOs, and our role is as the organizer of the information that comes in from a wide variety of participants. That's how I see our place. We're not necessarily the ones on the ground, but we're the ones who should be organizing the information coming back in from a multitude of those people who are on the ground.
Is this on? Jan Spiegel, Connecticut Mirror. The thing that always worries me with data, which, you know, personally I don't have any problem with, is interpreting it correctly. And, you know, you can get numbers six ways from Sunday, but until you get, you know, expert information to help you decipher what it is you're looking at, you may have a whole misimpression. Are there any thoughts, advice, suggestions, you know, additional hand-wringing for us to make sure that that we're understanding what we're seeing?
I mean, I'm going to just go right back ended with about community. So Public Lab it's made up of journalists, technologists, scientists. Scott Eustace, who I'm going to point out to him, is standing in the back of the room, is a wetland scientist with Gulf Restoration Network. We just finished wrapping up a year-long project mapping land loss in Barataria Bay. This included people with GIS expertise, a social ecologist, Scott, who's a wetland scientist, and people that are, you know, outreach folks and boat captains. I mean, so it's really about bringing together a group of like-minded individuals or organizations that are intrigued and interested in exploring a certain topic and figuring out how to really pull off the different personal expertises that everybody has. And this is really what's driven all of our projects. You know, at this point, if we're talking on a global scale, we have people from the EPA that are in the public lab community. And so, you know, when we get to the point that we're talking about data verification and doing calibrations, you know, we have certain outlets that we can start looking towards. So for me, that's the most important thing that I've learned, is about stepping outside of our own fields and really, you know, leaning on other people and bringing other people in to really create a cooperative network.
And yeah, just following up on Shannon, like getting outside of your own networks, scientists are very much interested in that process as well. They're just as interested in understanding what the community is interested in knowing, because they're, you know, they've been beaming data down at us from space without actually understanding how people are using it. So they're just as interested in hearing from the community and what they're interested in knowing as anybody else. And so, you know, for example, if fishermen in Barataria Bay are wondering to know where salinity is coming from and whatnot, and they're like, well, we can't get that data necessarily easily, but, you know, there's a satellite that actually can provide it. And those scientists who designed that satellite may not even know that the community wants to know that information. Likewise, when we start looking at OCO2 photosynthesis, you know, like photosynthesis from space, we may see a signal from, you know, that certain areas of the bayou or the wetlands are not photosynthesizing. And then we can actually access our community and say, hey, what's going on down there? So it's a two-way communication conversation that we're trying to have, and it's okay not to have answers. When scientists answer questions on the almanac, they sometimes will say something like, is it okay if I tell them and I don't know, but I'm really interested in hearing what they have to say? That is awesome, because we're all experts in our own backyard, and the more we're kind of exchanging that information and being honest about what the information can and can't do, the more we learn.
I mean, I would second all of that, but I also add on a kind of practical level for working journalists that are trying to figure out how to convene a project like this. There are not coincidentally a lot of online resources for data journalism and understanding data. So a lot of the sort of the massive online courses are focused on data. You can find them online. You can go to Poynter, the website, POYNTER. And also, Willie mentioned the Tau Center at Columbia. They have a major emphasis on data. They have workshops and meetings if you're in the New York area. Also, I'll shill for, you know, CUNY Graduate Journalism School. You know, data journalism is a big part of what we do, and we do workshops. It's not just for, full-time graduate students. So I think those kinds of resources can help you understand the potential, but also how to work with the data once you have it, how to visualize it, how to share it back to the community.
I'll just add very quickly, make friends with the scientists. That's the best advice we can give you. There you go. I got one right there. I got a new friend. Okay, just repeating that public lab's going to be leading a test on the bike tour this afternoon at 2:00 if you're interested. Any other questions? Yes.
Hi, I'm Beverly Payton with Stroud Water Research Center. We have scientists and public education, environmental education educators, created two citizen monitoring programs that we would love to actually have journalists participate in. One is called the Leaf Pack Network, in which citizen scientists, students can go out, drop a pack of leaves in an onion bag in their local streams, leave it there for 2 weeks, come back, collect it, and sample the macroinvertebrates and sort them out. We have tools, you know, that can help you do that. And by determining the species and the numbers and the diversity of the species of macroinvertebrates living there, you can get a very, very clear estimate of the health of your streams in your local watershed. The other thing that we have is then they can upload that data onto the LeafPack network, and that will then be incorporated into a massive database that will be sorted out and filtered and made available to scientists, you know, whoever is doing stream research. Because obviously we don't have the bandwidth to send scientists out to all the different streams and communities, you know, throughout the nation. But having, you know, citizen journalists, you know, scientists doing that would be an excellent way to get more data points. The other thing we have is called Wiki Watershed. We just got a big grant from National Science Foundation to expand that to the entire continental United States. That will be coming online in another couple of years. We're working with numerous partners on that. Wiki Watershed will allow people to go into the wiki, you know, point out a geographic location, find out what the quality of their watershed is based on the data that we've uploaded, and the critical zone observatory data is also incorporated in that.
It would be great. Do you think you could leave some information on the back table that people could
actually,
have?
Yes, and I have a booth over here that I would love to have, and I have some information on my press kit where you can go and
thank
visit
you.
On our site. Thank you.
Thank you. And can I just mention on this topic of water quality, there's also work being done on a cheap water quality sensor, work by our partners in Brazil and by MIT Media Lab. So if you're interested in that, feel free to come talk to me about that. Yes, question. We had a question here.
Yeah, hi, David Steincross, freelance from Wisconsin. I have a question for Willie. You said your cheap sensor is accurate on an hourly basis. So how? Where does that break down compared to the $10,000 sensor? I mean, is weekly, does it go out of calibration in a month? What's the problem?
So essentially that hourly interval is how the data is being aggregated. So if you look at a second-by-second level, because you can get those kind of readings. You can say, what's the difference, you know, 10 seconds from now is, you know, right now. Like, actually, one of the things at conferences, so you can find, like, an event that says, we're going to walk out of this room and all the dust is going to come up off the carpet. And we can say, we can measure that. That's measurable. But if you're looking at outdoor, like, ambient quality, that there's a difference in the data. If you look at, all right, we're going to say 5 minutes. What was the difference in 5 minutes? Oh, there's, but if you aggregate all of the particulates that have come in over an hourly interval, so you say 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, up to 24, and then the data is comparable. So that, it's about how the data is viewed. Not necessarily, so that's like one of these kind of important corollaries. Like, as soon as you start getting into this, you realize, like, how difficult and, like, kind of anal retentive a lot of scientists are about calibrations and things like that. But it's real. I mean, when we did that mobile sensor, people were like, well, are you driving fast? Is that going to affect the amount of air that's coming into the sensor? You know, so as soon as you try something new, you run into a major question. So we've been really focused on put these things in one place for a few weeks at a time, identify a point source, which you can also kind of do from satellite. You can look at particulate matter from satellites. You can identify a point source, and you can build a radius and say, we're going to case it for a couple weeks and then get that data back, look at hourly intervals, and maybe even make a prediction saying it's that factory or it's that location.
Yeah. I see if you can be able to measure aerosols as well. So a lot of this, I mean, so a lot of these are very, very complementary, like over time. But this, I just brought this. This is a sensor that you can plug into your phone and your computer, sensor drone. But it's really good at measuring carbon inside. But when you do it outside, things get really, really tricky. So, you know, when you take a bunch of measurements from, like, if you take, like, 1,000 measurements, that, you know, if you aggregate and correct, that might actually be more accurate than a satellite, right? And so that's what NASA is recognizing, is they're interested in this because they realize that their data alone is not going to really give them the information that we can use to really learn something over time. So.
Megan, you're going to have the last question. I just want to show you one more sensor you can have on your phone. Noise sensor. This costs $4, and we've tested it out compared to a professionally made noise decibel measuring sensor, and it works pretty well. Noise pollution isn't a particularly sexy issue. You don't see it reported on very, very much, but it's actually really critical to public health. It's a really underreported issue, and this is a way to measure noise data very, very cheaply. It's called Splift. It's not a good name. It's called SPLNFFT. SPLNFFT. It costs $3.99, and you can get great stories out of it. Megan, I think you got the last word, or the last question.
Thanks. I'm Megan Parker. I'm the editor with the Woodrow Wilson Center. And I had what I hope is a quick question. How do you address privacy or security concerns? I mean, particularly when you're having folks in developing countries collecting data that governments may not really want them to be collecting or sharing. How do you reflect that? I know everybody's a volunteer in your project, but there are, you know, potentially some issues with data mining and or privacy.
I would first say that especially in a lot of the work that our community does, it's not just in developing countries. When you're working around extractive industry in the United States, slap suits, oil and gas industry, it's crazy. So we, into all of our web platforms, have pretty deep security measures that are built in. But when we're actually helping people think through projects, you know, we really stress that, you know, think about, like, from a community perspective, is this something you want to release into the public domain? And I guess one other thing I would say is just because communities are open source or working in open source models doesn't mean that they have to have public data. That's two completely separate things. So people can, we work with a group in Jerusalem that's doing community mapping in a neighborhood called Silwan. And so they, I think this year, decided to release a lot of the imagery they collected a couple years back. But even though they were using our methodology as they were collecting data, they decided to keep it locked and private so that it wouldn't be accessible by other people.
Yeah, I know Leah from Woodrow Wilson is kind of focused on this. And this is, in fact, you know, opening up. We're in a new era, and we're asking these questions almost in every domain of our lives. You know, where is the line? And I think that most of these projects are designed to try and create information for communities and work with communities to answer the questions that they're wanting to answer and provide solutions. And that working with them, you know, one-on-one is the best way to kind of sort out the big issues. But we're all figuring it out.
Yeah. I mean, at a most basic level, in terms of the presentation of that information, it's about generalizing what you've got so that it doesn't actually include a real location. It's a general location about a specific area that doesn't necessarily attach to a person's home or something like that. So I think that we have a responsibility to generalize. There's also a focus on the chain of information. And where are there potential issues? But I think that, you know, kind of echoing what Julia just had to say, I mean, the privacy implications are pretty massive, especially for non-environmental issues, because these topics, like these tools are not just confined to environmental sensing. Like the fact that, you know, I can know when, if you put one of these things in your home and you put it out publicly, I can know when you're home, when you're cooking. I can know, you know, when we all leave this room based upon inferences. And a lot of that's actually covered in that toe sensor, the toe sense, that report, where we focused a lot on what are the implications here? What's that balance between the sunlight that you can cast into these dark corners and that line of privacy where it's could be used by, you know, people with bad intentions for ways that we can't even imagine.
I think also to be a modern citizen, you are aware of data and privacy issues. I think you can't not be. And you know, frankly, with small farmers and ranchers, we had great success with IC Change. But the larger scale farmers who felt that might be like who worked directly with NOAA, who was like, I totally thought they were going to be participating in a big way. And they didn't because they didn't want to give away their price vulnerabilities. But the small farmers next door to them did and had no problem with it. And so we knew that there was a problem with invasive weeds that were going to send the price of hay up, right? So you know, everybody has their, you know, their line, and they have to kind of determine it for themselves.
Thank you, everyone. So, Thank you. So it's a brave new world out there, an exciting one, and lots of risks, but lots of potential. Can we have a round of applause for our panel? Thank you very much.